You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Today, members of the Dorothy Day House Catholic Worker came together to offer officers and personnel inside the Marine Corps barracks in Washington, D.C., an alternative to fighting in the impending war against Iraq. David Russo was there and files this report.
Brothers and sisters in the military, refuse to fight. Refuse to kill. You are being ordered to war by a president who was never elected, who has never fought in a war, and who is saying that it is acceptable to use nuclear weapons.
Nine people held signs and chanted pleas at the Marine Corps barracks entrance in Northeast Washington, D.C. today, demanding they refuse to kill in war. As vehicles filled with young personnel entered and exited the gates to the barracks, the four women and five men from Washington's Dorothy Day Catholic Worker and Jonah House in Baltimore, Maryland, used a megaphone to read the names of people who have pledged not to kill in war.
You are being ordered to war in the footsteps of veterans who, more than 10 years ago, were sent to fight in the first Gulf War. Many of those vets returned with severe and unacknowledged illnesses. Many gave birth to severely deformed children. Many were abandoned by the Veterans Administration. You are being ordered to war by the most powerful nation on earth. You are being ordered to war by a nation with the most destructive weapons ever conceived, developed, deployed, or used. This nation can have no moral justification for war.
And what's your name?
I'm Daniel Kiesler.
And how old are you?
I'm 18. I work in the neighborhood of Trinidad. I just happen to be across the street and passing by.
I think it's definitely a really important part of anti-war organizing to be, you know, reaching out to the military ranks. I mean, during the Vietnam War, organizing, you know, amongst soldiers resisting the war was very strong. And I mean, that's definitely a really important part of anti-war organizing.
We, the undersigned, are convinced that war is the greatest evil on earth. We believe that humankind must end war, or war will end humankind and, in fact, all of creation. Our convictions have driven us time and again to the Pentagon, White House, and Congress in acts of civil resistance to war. Now, we bring our plea to you, sisters and brothers in the armed forces. Refuse to kill. Refuse the order to go to war. Leave the military before it is too late.
Elizabeth McAllister came down from Baltimore for the frigid demonstration. The widow of longtime peace activist Philip Berrigan reflected on previous refusenik recruitment. So can you tell me how long you've been doing this?
65. Since 1965.
And how many people have you seen actually refuse to work in the military over your lifetime?
Well, during the Vietnam War years, there were quite a few who would leave for conscience reasons, and people would support them. And I have had, during those years, I had many people sit and talk to them and support them and help them and shelter them. And I remember during the last Gulf War, there were people who refused to go and were treated very, very badly by the military because of it. There's a group of friends we have who do a weekly vigil against this war in Columbia, Maryland, and they were brutally attacked. Car drove right into their vigil line on the sidewalk.
Wow, when did this happen?
A couple of months ago.
Mm-hmm. Was it reported?
Yeah, it was reported. And rather than stop the vigil, it increased it. Thank God.
Mm-hmm. We're hoping today that we can at least convince at least a couple people to consider maybe refusing to fight, and we would be offering to take them in and help them in any ways we possibly could, or at least to consider, you know, conscientious objection, to call up the GI Rights hotline and just see. Because this war is completely unjustified. I mean, it's coming out in the press now that some of the evidence that Colin Powell presented was from back 12 years ago and things like that. I mean, they're pushing for a war, and they're using false pretenses just like they did the last time. My name's Gary Ashbeck. I live at the Jonah House community in Baltimore.
The GI Rights hotline was announced several times during the demonstration. When calling the hotline at 1-800-394-9544, one can receive assistance from a consortium of 10 offices nationwide. J.E. McNeil, executive director of the Center on Consciousness and War, explained that the 60-year-old organization received thousands of calls nationwide.
I just want to try to get a comment from anybody. You don't have any comment? Does this happen a lot here? No.
Just go back up.
How long have you been here?
Just go back up.
Is it difficult to watch this as you work?
Go back down.
Although no one would comment at the Marine Corps barracks on the demonstration, I met an Air Force officer on the metro working on a laptop.
I mean, you've been in the Air Force for 10 years, so you've seen, I'm sure, a lot of arguments and discussions from people in the military and not in the military. What is it like from your perspective watching peace groups and demonstrations against war?
I don't even really watch the demonstrations. It doesn't really involve me. I don't know.
Did you see any kind of coverage on C-SPAN or anything of the past demonstrations?
I don't even watch the news.
For Pacificus Peace Watch and the D.C. Independent Media Center, this is David Russo.
The U.S. military has been working on a super soldier program for years now, trying to engineer a better soldier through the use of steroids, amphetamines, and a variety of other means. The project is run by DARPANET, the same people who brought you the Total Information Awareness Eavesdropping Plan. Jerry Quickly from Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles spoke with Gulf War veteran Joyce Riley about the super soldier program and the drugs being given to U.S. combat pilots operating in Iraq.
The Super Soldier Project. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much of this enters in, but I have confirmed that during the first Gulf War, the same dextroamphetamine that's being given to our troops now, and as, of course, you were touching on the issue of the Canadian friendly fire incident, this all comes together because they now have determined that these troops are being given, or these pilots are being given, 10 milligrams of dextroamphetamine for their flights. It's put into their aircraft. They take it as they will to stay awake. The reason they're having to take these drugs is because they're so far away from their staging areas. There's 10 hours away, 12 hours away, and you're alone in an F-16, and you have to take those pills to stay awake, or so they say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our troops during Desert Storm took dextroamphetamine, but they took 5 milligrams. They were also given some other drugs to create and bring about this quote-unquote super soldier project.
Yeah.
So the U.S. government now, through the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, has a project called the Super Soldier, or it is called the the War Fighter Enhancement Program,
mm-hmm.
War Fighter Enhancement, in which they want to create these super soldiers. Now, this has been going on for a long time.
Better soldiers through drugs and in genetic engineering.
Exactly. And the goal of this is to do it to keep them awake for 7 days without any need of any sleep and to keep them from needing any food for 7 days. So what they've been doing is propelling these guys with whatever form of synthetic steroids or whatever they can find. I mean, there's been a number of things that have been tried. And even now they're considering electromagnetic brain zaps to fight off sleeping so that they can stay awake. Now, I can't imagine anybody that would want to apply for one of those jobs. But they want iron-bodied and iron-willed fierce fighters who can attack day and night without rest. Their combat spirit, keep it soaring and keep them alert. And it's just not possible. But they're even considering utilizing brain cells from animals that migrate without sleeping, such as birds that go long distances without sleeping. They're thinking in terms of putting that into their brains. I mean,
what's wrong with that?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, why don't we just play God or be God here? And this is just a phenomenal situation. These troops are complaining to us. They've contacted us and said, the problem with this project is, yeah, 8 to 5, they may experiment on the troops, but then when you go home at night, you can't turn it off. And so your wife wakes you up in the middle of the night to tell you to put the dog out or something, and you want to kill her.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've had a number of murders happening in the military, and a lot of them are not justified. In other words, they weren't people having problems. They weren't people with prior violent exposures. And now all of a sudden, people are being killed for no reason. An example, a Gulf War veteran went in to look for a car in Florida. The used car salesman said to him, now, are you serious about buying a car? Or are you just kicking tires today? He took that as an offense. He picked up a hammer and he bludgeoned the man to death. Now, that makes no sense. The man didn't even know him. And yet, these people are now kicked to the side of the curb like dead animals. And we found in one government document, Senate Report 103-647, that says that our troops are experiencing violence far out of the norm of what they experienced prior to the war. Now, that was a document we found written in 1993. So the U.S. government has known this. The DOD has known this since day one. We've got numerous people now in prison for life sentences that I've been dealing with, and it is so sad. Half of them don't remember the crime, and this is not a defense. We're talking about sarin gas exposure. We're talking about being part of a super soldier project, whatever. But we're talking about areas that enter into their well-being or their defense that no one even considers. I went to testify for a pilot. He was a commander of his unit, and he killed his wife. Now, I'm not justifying anybody doing any violent act at all, but he didn't even know what was happening. The night before, he was playing like he was a helicopter, and he was seen and observed to be flying around like he was the helicopter. Mm. The next day, he killed his wife. Now, I went down, and I went down on my own dime, went down there to testify as an expert witness on behalf of Gulf War illness, and the judge threw it out of the court. Literally said, it's not even going to be entered in here. Mm-hmm. Now, that's what these troops are being met with. So when people are considering sending their sons and daughters off to war, you'd better expect that when they come back, they're on their own. And that's a very sad thing for our veterans to have to face.
Gulf War veteran Joyce Riley is speaking with Jerry Quickly from Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. While stories about the Bush administration's buildup for an attack on Iraq dominate the headlines, a bill requesting universal access to free health care for U.S. citizens got very little attention. Reem Kathuta, Peace Watch producer for Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, has more in this report.
The cost of invading Iraq is estimated to $1.9 trillion, according to the National Network to End the War Against Iraq. Meanwhile, Michigan Congressman Conyers in Washington, D.C., unveiled the United States National Health Insurance Act. If passed, this reform will guarantee every person in the United States access to a decent and free health care based on a vision for a national health care insurance paid for by the government. This Conyers-McDermott proposed health care bill should save over $56 billion a year, says Joel Siegel, the legislative assistant for health care for Congressman John Conyers.
The tax cut for Bush is really close to $4 trillion over 10 years. Massive tax breaks for those who don't need them, Americans from the 1% to 5% wage bracket. If there's a war, God forbid, in Iraq, I mean, the spending on that would be astronomical. What we say in our bill is we can easily cover the cost of our national health insurance bill and save $58 billion a year in the process, cut small business costs down, cut consumer costs down, and still cover everyone. And that's the litmus test. Let's see if any other member of Congress or senator or the president can match what we have. We can easily afford to do this. It's just that as long as you have an administration and a Congress that cares more about the profits of HMOs and insurance companies and don't care about the quality of life for our citizens, then it'll be difficult to cover everyone. What we need now is for the listeners, the American people, to call their members of Congress. You can call 202-225-3121 and ask that they become a co-sponsor of the United States National Health Insurance Act, H.R. 521, because what Americans don't understand is that your letters, your faxes, your phone calls do count. If we get 10 to 15 phone calls in here from Detroit constituents, we have to have a meeting with the staff and Mr. Conyers. Only 20% of the American people vote. An infinitesimal amount of that category makes phone calls to their members of Congress. So we need the people to be heard, because the people united will never be defeated. And we have a lot of people, 40 million who are uninsured, 50 million underinsured.
This health care bill was unveiled after 35 years of diligent efforts towards universal health care accessible to all by Congressman Conyers. And at a time where less and less rights are given to immigrants, this measure includes people who live here as opposed to citizens, insures Congressman Conyers.
A sick person in the country can create as much problem in terms of having a healthy country as a sick citizen in the country. So you can't tell a person that because they're sick and need care desperately, you're not a citizen, so you don't count. No.
I asked the congressman for his comment about the USA's build-up for a war against Iraq as he comes out of a hard work for a national health care bill.
Sometimes great issues are connected, even though they're not the same subject matter. We can't afford a war in Iraq, number one. Number two, an immoral war against anybody compromises our democratic principles that start with the Constitution and flow from there. So we're not in a position to commit our soldiers, our young people, men and women, to a war for which there's no justification. May I speak in defense of the president? The fact that he has no military experience shouldn't preclude him from being able to figure out that we should be waging peace and not war. You don't have to be in the military to figure that out, although General Schwarzkopf, who led the last Middle East war, thinks that Bush, who he voted for, is all wet. But it doesn't turn on whether you've been in the service or not. It turns on whether you have a vision for what this world ought to be as the most powerful, influential nation in the planet. I believe there are 223 different nations in the world right now. None of them have the influence, the impact on the others that we do. So everything we do has an international dimension to begin with. When we do something here domestically, for example, when General Ashcroft says, let's count the mosques in all the FBI field offices, that's heard around the world. You can't take racial profiling and add religious profiling to it and think that nobody else cares here except people of Arab or Chaldean descent. Everything we do resonates around the world. We've got to begin to examine a political system that allows not just for a black to be punished for speaking out on their opinion, but for everybody being quiet when that happens to someone that's not with them.
Finally, Congressman Conyers talked about personal responsibilities in a democracy.
Each person has to become more active to motivate themselves. It sounds a little corny to be talking about reasons why everybody has to vote when we have a president who lost the popular vote but was appointed anyway. Most of the media is totally tilted because they're in the profit-taking part of our system, just like those that take profits out of delivering health services. There needs to be 100 Pacificas. We all have to realize that somehow we have to motivate, energize, teach, lead, inspire those who have given up on the political process, which is why most people don't vote, that they don't think it's going to really change what food gets put on their table or whether their rent will be paid or whether their kids will get an education. In the end, everybody counts. Every election, we have people who win by one vote, by two votes, Even in the Congress, the Democratic whip was decided with over 200 people, one vote among us. And so that's what we have to overcome. And I think we can. The one thing that consoles me even when Bush tries to get my spirits down is that there are way more of us than there are of them. And I think sometimes even Mr. Bush at his more bright moments that he knows it too.
From WPFW, Pacifica Station in Washington, D.C., I'm Reem Kathoda, reporting for Peace Watch.
Finally, on a somewhat lighter note, we turn to folk singer and self-described peacenik Fred Starner, who's been singing out and sitting in for over 30 years. Starner has written extensively about the Bush administration and U.S. acts of aggression at home and abroad. Peace Watch spoke with him recently about what drives his activism.
Well, of course, in my circles, everybody is very strongly against it, and the folks that deal with, quote, traditional music, because of their programs, they don't generally, they probably wouldn't sing an anti-war song. And I'm going to be, for example, an artist in residence in Coffeyville, Kansas, in September, and the people put me in there, Fred, don't sing any political talk, because I'm supposed to talk about the history of the banjo and all that kind of stuff. But then we had a very nice discussion about, the war. And so this is not a scientific sample, but I would guess the folk community is pretty much united against the war effort. I think, as a performer, particularly if you hold contrarian views, you have to respect your audience. And in most cases, I only do an hour's program.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to set the audience off. And I, incidentally, sang at the Air Force Academy in October.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously I wanted to do some songs critical of Bush, but I sang for 2 hours, so I had a set about songs of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And I started with the Revolutionary War, explained what Yankee Doodle was all about, and a soldier song that was written by a British officer who made fun of the American uniform, stuck a feather in his hat and called it macaroni.
Mm-hmm.
And he was making fun, and worked my way through the First World War, the Second World War, and Vietnam, of course, and then up to the present. And then I warned the cadets that the next couple songs are critical of their commander-in-chief.
Mm-hmm.
And
what kind of response did you get?
Well, I got a very good response, and I think I sent you folks that flyer that the cadets signed, and they thanked me for raising new ideas and thank me for bringing a different perspective. And I shook hands with most of the people. It was a small, affair, 100 people maybe at the most.
Mm-hmm.
So it was gratifying, and I think it. In the first place, I don't blame the cadets at the Air Force Academy for our American foreign policy. That's in the hands of somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of it.
Now, I know you have a song, Old King George, where you compare the impending attack on Iraq with the American Revolution. Interesting parallel.
Well, that's it came from a fragment of a comment that Pete Seeger made 30 years ago at Oberlin College, where I first heard him. And he said, just kind of offhanded, it was a good thing that King George didn't have B-52s. And then he sang the rifleman of Bennington.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I got to Denver in October, when you drive through the entrance of the Air Force Academy, there's a B-52 there on a pedestal, and you drive right by it. 3 days later, at Lowry Air Force Base, which is now closed, where we protested the president's appearance, Mr. Bush, about 1,000 of us, there's another B-52. Parked 100 feet from us. There was a fence separating us from the entrance to the hangar. So I said, geez. And Pete's comment came in. So that's the book. Good thing old King George didn't have B-52s. The British Empire would still be around. There'd be no red, white, and blue.
Still be around. There'd be no red, white, and blue. We
Starner, activist and folk singer. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Reem Karhuda, and Deepa Fernandez. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit Pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. Email us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.
So do you catch the drift? Mideast reeks with the smell. We need oil desperately, so we'll bomb to get the oil wells. And if you want the truth, well, deal with this fact. Our embargo killed thousands. We laid them on their backs. So Saddam is a monster, war criminal, I bet. But we kill babies and grandmas. Isn't that some kind of criminal debt? Bush's, Clinton, Albright, all united in that goal. Cut off these goods into Iraq, but didn't they lose their souls? Think old King George didn't have B-52s. British Empire'd still be round, there'd be no red, white, and blue.